It's just you and I, Senator.
We can do it. We've done that before.
We have. Usually it was the other way around.
Yeah.
I just want to give people a little sense of the lineup here. So first we're going to hear HJM 17. Then we will move on to Farm to School, and that'll take about 45 minutes. Then 3211. And then if we have time, we'll do the last one. So those of you who are here on 3211, it's probably going to be an hour before we get to it. I would love it if you'd stay and watch and learn about the Farm to School program, but if you don't want to, you've got a little time to do other things and feed the car meters, those kind of things, just to give people a sense of schedule today. And I am expecting committee members eventually, except for Representative Gilliam, who has a surgery starting in about 30 minutes up in Portland on his knee. With that, let me open a public hearing on HJM 17. Because my colleague Senator Roblin is due to chair another committee starting in about 7 minutes in another room. And is Representative Boone here?
Dr. Sisma is here if he wants to come up.
Who is?
Dr. Sisma.
Sure, yeah. Mark?
Come on up.
I haven't seen Mark in a while.
I don't see Boone.
So Chair Klim and absent members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arne Roblin, and I'm the state senator from District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook on the coast and into Sheridan and Falls City in the valley. It's one of those large districts. Yeah. I'm here because I am one of the vice presidents of a group called PENWAR, Pacific Northwest Economic Region, and they are an organization that our state belongs to, along with the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska, and the five western provinces or territories of Canada. So that includes the Northwest Territories, the Yukon, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. That group is the last part of North America that does not have quagga or zebra mussels. Every other section of North America has been invaded by quagga or zebra mussels. And
Representative Boone, you're welcome to.
And as such, our region took up the battle to try to keep out this invasive species because we understand how. Oh, good. You brought my. These are quagga mussels. That's 18 months in Lake Mead, a piece of irrigation pipe. And the issue about quagga and zebra mussels is they grow on top of each other. Each female lays 1 million or so eggs a year, and they can live outside of the water for a few days, but if they're in water, they can live for a long time. So we passed a bill a few years ago that allowed us to stop boats that were coming into Oregon and check them. In that time since we've done that, we've found a number of boats. The new boats called wake boats go to Lake Mead and they do wake. They have a tank in them for ballast. They can't completely empty those ballast tanks, so if you sucked in water that had some quagga mussel larva in it, and then you came to another lake and exchanged water in that tank, we could have an invasion. And we have not been successful in eradicating them in any body of water except one quarry that had water in it where they could kill everything that was in it. And so when they start multiplying, they create hundreds of millions of dollars of damage. They like our water because we have high calcium in our water. The place where they come from, over in Eastern Europe, has low calcium, so they kind of are self-regulated. They aren't in the Great Lakes, as people know, and we need to make sure we don't get them here. One of the ways we've been asking to do that was talking to the federal government, and they actually put in an authorization to spend about $20 million in Oregon to protect the Columbia River Basin and to do some work. The problem is they've authorized but not appropriated the money. So what this does is ask for our state to ask our federal delegation to authorize the money. Let's spend that money. Let's get ahead of this problem. Let's figure out things that we can do in the Columbia Basin and all of our other places to keep this potential danger out of our state. So I urge your support of this memorial, and I look forward to hearing my testimony from my buddy here in the House, Representative Boone.
And good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I always go after Senator Roblin because he does such a good job. I just do cleanup and Sherpa work. So this being said, as of, I think it was yesterday, and I sent to, I think, Ian and to you, Mr. Chair, a copy of a letter that our Oregon congressional delegation all signed on to urging the same for the for they were writing their letter to the committee. So you should have a copy of that in OLIS, and we like to think that they're backing up our memorial here, but in all, that's just a lot of extra juice for us to use. This is so important. I don't know. Apologize for being a little bit late. I don't know if you covered the Penware connection there. Okay. So this is a longstanding issue. If you looked at the map, as it's going from the East Coast and that's up into Lake Winnipeg, they have seen them up there. So far, the Northwest is clean, and we just want to keep it that way. And I think the Columbia River system is the system that would be the most damaging to Oregon if they got into it. So please support our bill.
And if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them before I have to take back and
why don't we do that?
Do you want to take
any questions for our colleagues, and then we'll have
Sorry?
The doctor
sit
go.
Back
with
I will.
Okay.
Questions for Senator Roblin?
Enjoy the muscles.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Does anybody have claim to that?
That particular
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great piece of art.
That's actually mine, and it came from a senator friend that I have in Idaho who has rented a space in Lake Mead, and he takes down every year license plates and pieces of irrigation pipe like that and other things, and hangs them off his boat, his deck. To show people back home how bad this is. Idaho has a program called a passport. When you come in, they will clean your boat when you cross the border, and then they give you a passport that says you can go on into Washington and Oregon because your boat has been cleaned. And they've done some more stuff than we have. They've spent more money on it than we have in the past number of years, though we're starting to catch up. But and cross-border things, another issue. We're trying to figure out if there's things that we can do if people are going back and forth across the border. The thing that's the scariest is we have found boats coming from every body of water out there across the nation that are coming to our state and to Idaho. We thought maybe if we just protect ourselves from Lake Mead and some of the California problems, we'd solve it. But we have people coming from the Great Lakes, from Florida, and if there's water in the boat and they're in it, they can survive, and that's what's really scary. And what's happened is the native fish get smaller and smaller because these are filter feeders, and they take everything out of the water and produce in the nutrients out there.
And you might ask why the federal government is not taking care of its lake. That's the big
That's
question
true.
Because they figured out it'd be about $5 million to address the problem at the source. And it's, you know, it's been suggested, begged for, et cetera, over the years, and still haven't gotten there yet. So working on it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for coming, Senator Roblin.
Thank you.
Mark, do you want to tell us?
Yes.
Tell us what you think about this.
Thank you,
memorial.
Chair Clinton, members of the committee. My name is Mark Sitzma. I'm a professor of environmental science and management at Portland State and associate vice president for research there. I'm also a member of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and I co-chair the Penware Invasive Species Working Group that Senator Roblin referred to. He did a good job of explaining sort of the impacts and the situation. The estimated cost for the Pacific Northwest if these mussels were to be introduced is about $500 million a year. Those costs include impacts to power generation because they have to shut down power plants to clean these mussels out of the pipes and off screens, increased maintenance of municipal water treatment plants. So any facility that uses raw water has a pipe in the water and is sucking it out. Irrigators or municipal water treatment facilities will have a problem with these mussels when they arrive, so they'll have to have increased maintenance. They're increased boat maintenance because they get inside boat motors and just damage them. And fish screens, waste gates, and trash screens. Anything that's in the water is going to be impacted by these mussels. The cost for Oregon is estimated at roughly $100 million a year if these mussels were to invade. So each state in the region has a mussel prevention program that involves inspecting boats when they come into the state. And the Invasive Species Council in Oregon and PNWR has worked hard to develop a regional approach to managing this. As Senator Roblin mentioned, we're the only region left. So we're trying to develop a perimeter defense and sort of act like a region rather than state by state, because we could be more efficient that way. The Oregon Boat Inspection Program is funded through a boat registration fee that generates about $540,000 a year that ODF&W uses to set up boat inspection stations. Senator Roblin also mentioned this is less money than other states have for their programs, but the ODF&W program is the most efficient in finding contaminated boats. Their cost per contaminated boat is about a quarter of Montana's and about 60% of Idaho's cost. So they're doing a really efficient job finding these boats. Senator Roblin also mentioned the $20 million appropriations authorization that we're trying to get appropriated. So basically there's a 50-50 match with the federal program, so we would double our funds available for boat inspections and monitoring for these mussels if Congress appropriated the money. So I do encourage you to support this memorial and send a really strong message to our congressional delegation. I should mention that other states in the region have similar memorials going forward, so we're hoping to get a flood of letters to congressional leadership and influence their decision about appropriating these funds. So thank you.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Just Representative Boone. Mark?
Yes.
Mark. I want to thank you and Senator Roman for bringing this. Every once in a while, we hear things here that I actually understand. And this I do. I have experience with it. And I hope that people get the understanding of epidemic. I don't know if that's the right word to use, that this could bring to Oregon. And I'm glad that you're working on this. And I'm very, very supportive. So thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, and my understanding is there's a Senate version as well, mm-hmm. and you're going to let us know which one you want to move after you're done wordsmithing.
I believe they're the same language, so
very similar.
I probably will have to dip to the Senate.
Defer to them.
Thank you.
Well, we'll see about that. Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
I'm sorry, before you gavel this out, and I apologize, I was testifying in a bill next door, and I'm sure this was mentioned before, but the entire Coastal Caucus is extremely supportive of this bill, and I'm happy to be on board with it.
Great. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me close the public hearing on HGM 17. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2721. And the speaker is going to join us to testify on this, but not, I think, for about 15 more minutes. For whatever reason, we did not get her signed onto the bill at this point, but she's been the chief co-sponsor with me for almost 10 years now, and so she'll be down to join us in a little bit. I will just stay up here and explain briefly, because there's a lot better folks here to tell us about the Farm to School program. This program originally, for me at least, came from a moment when I was sitting on, this is before I was in office, I was sitting on a tractor in our orchard, and there's a school that abuts our orchard, and I wondered whether we sell even our own fruit in that school, and it's like 50 yards away. And I thought, God, wouldn't it be strange if in the Hood River Valley we don't even sell to our own schools? And so I asked, and our sales situation is a little bit odd, where it goes into a great big giant co-op, and then people buy from that, and so I don't even know where it ends up most of the time. You know, I know it gets to Costco, but it's blended in with several other hundred other growers' fruit and called Northwest Fruit. So it became just something in the back of my mind that it would be good if that school, since that's the school that all of the local farmers' property taxes and the community's taxes are helping fund, would be able to support the farmer. After I got elected, I asked the Department of Ag, I said, have you guys thought about trying to get the schools to buy more? And they said, oh, you mean farm to school? And I said, well, I was thinking, yeah, maybe farm to institution. They said, no, it's farm to school. And we've had it on our kind of wish list of things that would really help the state since, I think, 2001. So it had been 6 years. He said, but we never actually had been able to get permission to introduce the bill. So it's always just been in a desk drawer. Are you interested in it? And I said, yeah. So they gave me the bill, and that was in 2007. And the speaker in particular kind of taught me the value of school gardens. I was only thinking about the procurement side and how beneficial would be for the farmers and also for the kids to have more locally grown produce. And then she brought me all these great people from several schools who had school gardens. So since that time, we have had quite a bit of success in the program with really very little state investment. And we are now the number one state in the country at procuring local foods for our school lunches, where 25% of our school lunches have an Oregon-grown product in their daily lunch program. And as I mentioned, it's been pretty modest. Like, we put in, I think, $125,000 one session, then another session, $125,000, and then finally the next time, I think we got $500,000, and then eventually we're now up to $1.25 million total. And to do this program really well, one of the things about this bill that's different than the ones we've had in the past, we're proposing that instead of having a grant program that would give 15 cents a meal to only the schools that win the grant because we don't have enough money to go around, that it become an across-the-board program for every school, even if it's a lower percent. So we used to say 15 cents of money will come from the state to your school district to buy Oregon-grown foods if you would use 15 cents of your federal money to buy Oregon-grown food. So it would leverage 30 cents on the dollar for the farmers to be able to have this new customer. But what we found is in some cases it's harder and more paperwork and more difficult for the schools to apply for and track the grant than it almost, they're still doing it, but it's almost not worth it to have to go through all the grant tracking and writing process. And we want to remove barriers and we want to bring more schools into the program. So this is a different approach in the past where we're asking for not the $20 million I always ask for, but $5 million, and not the 15 cents I always ask for, but 5 cents, or maybe it ends up being less than 5 cents if we have to negotiate. But we want to have an across-the-board program that would benefit every school, because I believe right now we only have 19 schools who are receiving grants, and while they're spread all over Oregon and they're here to tell us how great it is for them, you're going to know of other schools in your district that you wish had access to these state monies. And the last thing I'll say, the schools get no assistance from the state prior to the start of this program. There was essentially the question I asked, why don't you buy more Oregon-grown fruits and vegetables? They said, because you give us no money for it, and the federal program is a way that we can basically feed our kids at the lowest possible cost, and since we have no funds from the state for it, if you really want us to buy more local, we need a little carrot to get us going. So anyway, that's the background on the bill. That's kind of the Dash One Amendment. You'll hear more about that from people far more exciting to listen to than me. But this is it's been my priority since I've got here, is to try and get this program into every school in this state, and hopefully we will get there this session. Any questions for me? I think you'll enjoy the kids and parents and school gardeners a lot more anyway. So let me get to our list. Did I even open a public hearing?
Yeah.
Either that or I said it without it. That's fine. Rick Sherman, Amy Gilroy, do you want to come up first? And these are, when I said $125,000, that was to purchase 2 years of staff, one at the ODA, one at the ODE, which I have no idea if we've probably not given you a raise in 10 years, but this is them.
So. Okay, Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Rick Sherman. For the record, I'm Oregon Department of Education Farm to School School Garden Coordinator. And I manage the current bill that Representative Clem was talking about. And thank you for an overall picture. That makes my job a lot easier. I'll just have to fill in a few holes now. But among other things that I do, I help coordinate all the state, the school gardens that you spoke of in the state. And as you can see by the slide here, we're the only state that knows exactly how many school gardens we have. We currently, as of today, have 599 school gardens in the state, and we have a contact for each one. And I bring that up because for the purposes of this grant, since we have a contact for each one, we're able to integrate that and into the educational portion of this grant really nicely. So we already heard the background. Thank you very much. But ODE can, and we do a lot of educating and promoting in the schools, connecting schools to resources. But many of the schools are not going to attempt or be successful at a farm-to-school program unless they have help in the form of funding. Just speaking as a food service director, I was one for 20 years here in Oregon, and I know the food service directors have a hard enough time meeting the more and more stringent regulations and just breaking even. So when you ask them to do a farm-to-school program, they're like, okay, if I have time to do that and if I have the resources to do it. This grant has given the opportunity to provide funding to school districts to buy more local foods, implement food and garden-based education. Kind of funny thing about this is we know that the education piece is really necessary to get kids to eat and try local foods. Kids will not necessarily eat something that's placed before them that's healthy if you just put it on the lunch line. But if you, kids will make choices and are very interested in choices if they're presented with food and it's tied to an educational lesson. A couple really, really quick stories. When I was in Eugene as a food service director, we had a school garden day where we had a half a pan of lettuce available. That was all they could give us. We mixed it in with the regular lettuce we got off the truck. But our participation skyrocketed that day. Everybody came down because they wanted to try their own lettuce. Mm. And what's more, the community showed up. We had three TV stations, a newspaper, and a radio station covering one pan of lettuce. And so it was a big, huge deal. But if you just say, oh, yeah, here's some lettuce, kids, they may or may not do it. But you'll hear some other stories today from some farmers. You'll hear the same testimony when kids go to the farm. They'll make that connection too. I was at public school district and they had a kale and pear salad day, and it was the same thing. They not only ate that salad up because it was part of a lesson, we turned around and the display was gone. They had the big raw bundles of kale, and the kids were walking around eating them down to the fronds. And we're like, well, that wasn't intended, but they were, you know, when do you see that happening? It's just because of opportunities like this. It was just, it's really amazing. And I could go on and on, I won't, in terms of being out in the field and seeing this in action. It's really good. So as the proposed 21-1 legislation, as part of managing this grant, I hosted a meeting at ODE across the street to all the farm-to-school current grantees to get their pulse on how it was going and to get their feeling on how it's currently doing and what would they do to improve it. And so we got some of their ideas and wove that into the what you're seeing in front of you now. I already know that they're spending the money now that they have, and they're continuing to increase and find ways to spend. Once they get the vendors on board and a system, they take off and go really well. They've really increased everything, and they're on track to spend everything with the spring season to go before we're done with it. They like the current model of the educational piece, and it's currently at least 80% for food and at least 10% for education in the current model of House Bill 2649. But they would be receptive to a statewide non-competitive food distribution thing that Representative Klein talked about, with an accompanying competitive educational piece, as long as that education piece is there. From ODE's perspective, the proposed increase competitive educational portion of grant would continue to support the process I described. And then probably, and then just to finish up here with the fiscal piece, ODE does not anticipate that House Bill 2721-1 will have a discernible negative fiscal impact in ODE. ODE can continue to manage the grant in its current capacity, but we believe it's scalable and will continue to be able to manage the grant with the proposed changes.
Great, thanks.
And that's me.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Gilroy. I'm the farm-to-school manager with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I work very closely with Rick Sherman here at the Oregon Department of Education, and I've recently replaced Michelle Radcliffe at ODA. So I'm here today to talk a little bit about some of the investments that ODA has made in farm-to-school programming over the last few years. The first one that I wanted to share with you is the Oregon Harvest for Schools Toolkit. The toolkit's designed to help schools promote Oregon-grown fruits and vegetables in the cafeteria and the classroom. And over the past few years, state partners have worked with many of our farm-to-school groups in Oregon to develop menu planning tips, promotional posters, and family engagement materials for schools. The toolkit has grown from 12 initial Oregon specialty crops to recently 32. And so we have a few new additions just recently with the Oregon Harvest for Tools toolkit. We have kiwi, parsnip, and Brussels sprouts, for example. And so we're excited to share that the Oregon Harvest for School posters can be found in most, practically all of the school cafeterias in Oregon. So it's a very big contribution. The second investment that ODA is making in children's healthy habits is the Food Corps program. Food Corps is a national service organization providing nutrition education to kids and hands-on gardening experience. We currently have 10 service members here in Oregon. We have one in Tillamook, we have one in North Powder, and then we have many up and down the Willamette Valley. Food Corps is something that really helps fill a gap with a lot of under-resourced or low-resourced schools by supporting teachers and food service staff and helping them provide healthy food. And the third investment we're making is in Oregon farmers. Over the past few years, the program has demonstrated that many Oregon farmers see schools as a viable market channel for them to sell high-quality local products. Just within the grant program alone that Rick mentioned, the number of Oregon vendors selling to schools has more than doubled from 84 to 170 just in 2 years. So you can see, we feel that's a huge accomplishment. You can actually see on this map up here that a lot of these businesses represent Oregon far and wide. And so we have many of these that sell directly to schools. We also have a lot of local meat and seafood processors that are selling all across the state as well. Someone mentioned earlier that schools were funded or were leading the country in local purchasing. And schools that were funded in this recent grant cycle spent about 20% of their food budgets on local purchases. So the relationships that they have with these businesses do make a big difference. So where is there room to improve? Well, we have much to celebrate in Oregon, but we also have a long ways to go. Educating kids about healthy eating choices and promoting the benefits of local food in the classroom isn't enough. We need to make sure that healthy local options are on the school meal plate. It's essential to help these kids, for kids to make these choices daily. We also know that for some Oregon farmers, low financial margins keep them from selling to schools. Many of them care about putting local food on a child's lunch plate, but it has to pencil out for them. Schools are doing a great job of purchasing local foods, but it's only a fraction of the school dollar. Last year, schools spent about $66 million on food in Oregon, and much of that was spent on purchases outside the state. So there's real opportunity to take a look at scaling up supply. The Oregon Department of Agriculture does not have an official position on HB 2721, but it does see this program as an important way to keep dollars here in Oregon and feed our kids local and nutritious foods. Thank you.
Thanks. And we've got a fairly lengthy list, so I might not do too many questions and just try and get through the panel, but if there's anything immediate. And these folks, we can always get back over here. The rest of the folks came from a long ways away in some cases, so I want to make sure we get through everybody. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so Megan Campbell-Mully, McCarger, and Cindy Hyatt-Henry.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Megan Kempel. I serve as the Oregon State Lead for the National Farm to School Network. I'm based in Eugene, Oregon. I'm here in support of House Bill 2721 with the -1 amendments. I provide technical assistance and support to farm to school programs throughout Oregon. I also represent the Oregon Farm to School and School Garden Network with over 500 stakeholders. I'm here to give you an introduction to Farm to School and the other testimony you're going to hear today. Joining me is a great group of Farm to School supporters. Farm to School programs get local food into school cafeterias to support local farmers and processors and provide kids with healthy foods. The efforts to bring Oregon foods into the cafeteria work best when they're supplemented with agriculture, food, and garden-based educational activities that get kids excited about these foods. Together, these local purchasing and educational activities can support rural economies, provide kids with healthy foods, and help them develop healthier eating habits in the long term. Overall, Farm to School is good for kids, schools, and farmers. In 2011, the legislature created a grant program to award funds to school districts to purchase Oregon agricultural products and provide students with agriculture, food, and garden-based education. The program was piloted in 2011 with $200,000, and in 2013, the legislature expanded the successful program to $1.2 million in grants to school districts. Today, you'll hear testimony to expand and amend the current Farm to School Garden and School Garden program. The four amendments are as follows. First, in order for all schools to have equal access, 2721-1 changes the competitive grant program to a non-competitive grant that would give all schools a share of the funds for buying Oregon products. This will provide more opportunities for rural districts to participate and allow schools to count on the funds on an ongoing basis. Food producers also need this stability. Districts will need to opt in to the program and track and report on their Oregon food purchases. Second, in the current grant program, any products purchased with funds can only be used during lunch. House Bill 2721-1 would permit schools to use the funds for any of the school meal programs. Third, House Bill 2721-1 would separate the funding for food, agriculture, and garden-based education from the funds to purchase Oregon foods and continue to use competitive grants that schools need to apply for to award education funds. It would also allow nonprofit organizations and commodity commissions to apply for the education funds as well as the school districts. Many nonprofit partners are already providing these services but can't receive the funding directly. Finally, House Bill 2721-1 increases the total funding for the successful program. Specifically, it provides 5 cents per lunch served for a total of $4.5 million in food funding. Evaluations indicate an ideal farm-to-school allocation of 15 cents per meal, but 5 cents per meal is a meaningful start for both schools and producers. House Bill 2721-1 would also allocate $900,000 to competitive grants for the agriculture, food, and garden-based education, and 2% of the total grant dollars to Oregon Department of Education for administration. The total funding request is $5.6 million, which is an increase of $4.4 million from the current funding level. The program's been working well. It's done a lot for kids and for farmers and processors, but farm-to-school leaders and stakeholders in Oregon think it'll be more fair and more effective with these changes. We have panels of testimony now in support of House Bill 2721 from farmers, processors, students, school nutrition services staff, and advocates, and then we'll have time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Molly McCarter. I'm a fourth-generation farmer at Peermine Farms. Our family has been in the area farming for a little over 100 years and in our current location for about 80. My brother and I manage, I guess I should also say that I'm a mom of four girls. My oldest is actually here having a little civics lesson today with me, and I am a current vice chair of the Jervis School Board, Board of Directors, and our superintendent and our food service administration is here as well in support of this. But my brother and I both together farm 1,200 acres of vegetable row crops, sweet cherries, grass seed wheat, and now hops. We have to grow something that makes money. And unfortunately, it's not vegetables. But this season, we'll grow roughly at 500 acres of vegetable row crops for NORPAC. NORPAC's the largest processor in the Northwest, and it's family farmers own it. Over 240 family farms grow over 600 million pounds of vegetables annually, and it's processed right here in Salem. So our farm participates. So I'm not here to talk about why I want to sell products directly from our farm. I'm here to talk more along the lines of education. Our farm participates in several programs currently, and one of them is called an Adopt a Farmer program. Representative Post, that you're familiar with this, I've spoken about it before. This program is a volunteer program designed to help 6th, 7th, and 8th grade middle school science programs connect with ranchers and farmers around the state. And we pair them up and send the kids out to the farm, and the farmer and rancher goes into the classroom. And we do this for an entire academic year. I have been partnered currently for the last 3 years with Rachel Carson Environmental School, housed at a Five Oaks Middle School in Beaverton. I think Representative Helms is familiar with. And we've been together, I've been in the program for 4 years, and together with them for 3, and the kids, as you see in the slideshow running, have had an opportunity to not only they're learning every day how math, science, and those things relate to how food is processed and gets to their plates. So I have 180 students that come to the farm. And this year, I just finished up my 8th field trip last week. I have 45 students at a time. And each time, the 8th graders, this was their 3rd time out. And I should say their 6th time, because they came twice, school year. And every time there was something new that they learned, something new that they would ask about. Recently, they learned about the economics of farming. They all realized they're going to have to take second jobs at McDonald's if they want to be a farmer. But what they're picking up is what they're learning is where their food and fiber is coming from, how it's produced, where it's getting there, and then everything that goes into it. So it's extremely important for, I think, Oregon kids to come out and see these things and know and make the connections, especially between the urban and rural gap. And that way, they can appreciate all that goes into it, and the risks. And I apologize, I lost my place. But anyway, when kids see food grown on the farm or in their school gardens, and when they see it at lunch, they have a different appreciation for their food. And an example of that, I'll share an example of that in here in a moment. But I think as they learn to eat those things as middle school students or even at elementary level, they'll continue those habits as adults, and it will change their shopping patterns too. One dad, he has his daughter, I believe, is a 6th grader this year, and he came out to the field trip the first time this fall, and after I'd been in the classroom visiting with the kids, and he really enjoyed it. And then he came out again 2 weeks ago on the final field trip of the year. And we started chatting, and he wanted to thank me for this program, being able to have an opportunity to come down. And he said that everything that his daughter had learned and picked up just from conversations and being a part of the program with me has changed their buying habits in their household. Now, when they go shopping, they look for Saniam canned and flavor pack local NORPAC products. They know that things are packed in other labels, but they know that if they want to buy something that I grew, that's what they shop for now. And he used to not buy frozen food and canned vegetables because he said it's changed not only their buying habits but their cooking habits. He was a professional chef for 15 years, and so it was a big leap for him to go to the canned and frozen section rather than the quote-unquote fresh section. And so I think that made a pretty big statement of how important I think this education is in getting kids out to farms and making a difference. So with that, we have to continue these not only because they're future consumers, but these kids are also, we have to engage them because they're also future engineers, they're future policymakers, they're future truck drivers, they're future bankers, accountants, and without any sort of ag connection, it'll be very difficult for them to make decisions as an adult, I think, that will help keep farming viable in Oregon. So as a parent, as a school board member, as a farmer, I'm asking you to support the extension of the Farm to School program.
Quick comment.
Thank you. Let's do her first.
Question.
I know she's one of your people. So. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Chair Clem, committee members, thank you for allowing us to be here to speak in support of House Bill 2721-1. I'm Cindy Hyatt-Henry. I am the Nutrition Services Director for McMinnville School District, and I'm also the president of the Oregon School Nutrition Association. We have about 531 school district members. That includes school nutrition directors and cooks and food preparers and people who work in the schools, about 531 of them. My district is a current grantee of the Farm to School grant, and we have received approximately $27,000 from that grant. We have already spent that money on local produce, including apples, pears, grapes, tomatoes. We get corn in the fall, Yamhill County mushrooms, and we also bought educational materials that I have enough for you all to have some. We'll pass them around. Little stickers. This is an example of what we would give to a child if they would try a new food. And so the manager in front of the cashier would say, if you try this food today, you'll get a sticker. So I wanted you to see how some of the educational dollars were spent. We've also been involved in community efforts. We've participated in Yamhill County Soil and Water Conservation District events. They've had dinners. We go and we try to interface with farmers. We try to find the farmers. There's a upcoming Yamhill Valley Food Summit that's going to be in April that we are planning on going to so that we can source the farmers. We have worked with one local farmer in Yamhill County for over 20 years. But you need to know that it takes work on our part to source those farmers, and it has taken work. And I'm lucky in my school district because I have people who are passionate about this, and they help me. I have an employee who's very passionate. And we do this together. We source farmers, we source local products, but it takes time. And what we know is that small rural districts don't necessarily have people like myself or my employee that can devote the time, because what a lot of people don't understand is small districts very often hire a person from the community to be a cook, and then the manager above them leaves, and then the district decides that that cook will now be the manager, and then pretty soon that manager becomes the director. When that person signed on to be a cook, they didn't count on doing all of the federal paperwork or having to change what they've been doing every time there's a new guideline, a reauthorization in child nutrition, or whatever. I'm currently working with a local school school district in McMinnville that's parochial, where this just happened. The person had a review and needs help. They have very little income in their school to help train them. And I'm telling you all of this to say that a lot of the cook manager people in the rural school districts are not going to take on writing a competitive grant proposal. They don't have the time, they may not have the knowledge, and they just are done it at the end of 8 hours. So I support a non-competitive grant for the purchases of local foods for that reason. And all of our school districts would do the same. House Bill 2721-1 would create a predictable economy for farmers and for the school districts. It's a win-win. It would reduce the need to write episodic grant requests, which we have done. And honestly, in the past, I was one of those that Rick Sherman spoke about. I'm not going to write that grant. I don't have time to write that grant. But, gee, I'm really glad I did and that I've had the $27,000 this year. But the fear of the unknown is what keeps the small rural districts held back as well. The bill also allows Oregon districts to use Oregon food in any child nutrition program instead of just lunch. And I have to tell you that when we buy a case of apples, my cafeteria people have a real hard time sorting out that case of apples just for lunch and not for breakfast and not for after school. The programs merge together. Our food purchases merge together. So I believe this is a very good change to the bill also. The bill encourages other stakeholders as well to become involved in the competitive grants for education and farm-to-school gardens. I know of several members in our community who would become involved if they felt that they had an opportunity to gain some of the funds. So I believe this is another good aspect of the bill.
I probably should have you wrap up.
I'm finished. Thank you. Yeah. I was going to say thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm going to keep us moving because we've got some folks on schedule, including the Speaker of the House, who's waited patiently. Thank you, Madam Speaker. But while we're changing out between you three, who are excused, and the Speaker, Representative Post has, or Vice Chair Post has a comment he'd like to make.
Just real quick, I want to identify an affectionate term that I have for the many farmers in my district. One of them is Farmer Molly. I call them all Farmer Bob, Farmer Molly, Farmer Marie, whomever it might be, and that's a term of affection. What you saw in that slideshow, I just wanted everybody to know, I'm sure a lot of farmers are as active as she is in education, but I don't know of anybody that are as active as she is. And I want to applaud you. Thank you for coming today. When I heard you were coming today, I got pretty excited. So. Not important, but I needed to say that.
No, absolutely. Madam Speaker, welcome to the House Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. It's very good to be here. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, Speaker of the House. There is nothing like coming to a farm-to-school hearing. I've been doing this since 2007. The only difference, Mr. Chair, is you're not sitting next to me.
I know.
We've been doing this together for 8 years. I feel a little lonely here.
I'm just going to come sit there.
there you go.
Talk.
Really, you can feel the enthusiasm in the room. And I'm proudly here today to support House Bill 2721 and the Dash 1 Amendment. You're going to hear a lot of testimony today talking about how wonderful the work here in the state has been. Representative Clem and I have been working on this since our first session together. And what you will hear, too, is an evolution of a program that so masterfully connects ag and schools in an educational setting that supports communities economically, supports students educationally. The way we have done both the meal reimbursement as well as the grants to support school-based educational programs, garden programs, agricultural education programs, that linkage has been really important. What's good about the Dash 1 Amendment is it builds on the success that's happened over the years. It also provides more flexibility. I think the comment about being able to use any of the food through this program and any of the nutrition programs during the course of the day is a really good move. I also think that moving to non-competitive on the actual meal allocation for the schools makes a lot of sense. At some point, we need to move. We're moving. This is the next phase of this program. It's saying making it easier for every school who wants to participate. Now, we would argue it should be 15 cents a meal. If you know the history of this program, we've asked for bigger dollars at one point in time. And maybe the $5.6 million ask that's connected to this bill seems like a lot. But the benefit and the return on investment is proven. We've managed to be a model in the country in continuing to maintain our staffing in both the Department of Ag and Department of Education. We have wonderful success stories at the school level. This takes it to the next level. And you know, if every member on this committee, including the two sitting here, prioritize this allocation, we'd be able to fund the next phase of farm to school. I've never heard anyone say this is a bad idea. It's about whether we keep going and moving forward, because the benefits to ag, the agricultural communities, the benefits to the students, the benefits to the educational setting, the benefits to everyone involved, it's a given. So we just need to keep moving forward, and hopefully we can get that $5.6 million to do the competitive grants as well as the non-competitive grants that will go to each individual school in an easier fashion who wants to participate. And, you know, Representative Clem and I will keep doing this year after year to grow this program because it's so good for Oregon. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Any questions?
There's nothing I can say to improve on that.
Plus, I talked earlier.
There you go. Thank you, colleagues. Any questions for me? Otherwise, I'll just say hi to my friends and take off. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're going to like this next one. Noah and Lazar and Karina, can you come up? So, colleagues, for those of you who, nobody was on this committee before. Everybody here, this committee got a chance to both hear from students from Mullala High School and about their program, and then I think in the interim committee days, the very last one we went, met them at a school in my district that's a elementary school, and so the Mullala High School students were able to talk to these elementary school students about their program. And it was really cool to get to see the mentorship already beginning and inviting each other to the future events at their other garden partners from in the Valley. So please.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Noah Klein. I'm a sophomore at Mullala High School. And I'm going to talk about Culture Club in our school today and how it's an example of the farm garden to school program bill. Culture Club was originally started as a little 8-person club, you know, just for homework studying for some Russians in our school, and in their culture, you know, they're Russian Orthodox, they garden. So they began gardening, but other students in our school started seeing that, and they were like, hey, we want to join you. And so all of a sudden we started just snowballing, and more students started joining the club, and by the end of the year we had over 150 students join the club, and we had this huge garden that we completed in one day, huge, and we started producing a lot of product. And it's been, you know, our school was a recipient of the grants that you guys have done to this program, and some of the things that we've been able to do with that and the benefits of that are completely and totally astounding of what we've been able to accomplish. Just some examples of what we've done last year and this year. We donated over 100 pounds of fresh produce and vegetables to Meals on Wheels. And during the Escada Fire last year, we donated over 109 pounds of fresh vegetables to the Escada firefighters. And we have our own, what we like to call our micro-enterprise business plan. It's basically a system of where the staff puts almost an order on some of the products that we can produce in our garden, and they pay us, and they buy some of the products that we have in our garden. And it's really incredible to be able to see that going on, and it's completely student-ran. So it teaches, you know, it's really cool because it connects the education part of it, because it teaches us how to handle the money, how to place orders, and whatnot. And it's really interesting to be able to see that happen. And another thing is, too, we've also, the products that we grow in our garden, a portion of it goes to our school cafeteria, and we eat that every day in our school lunches. So it's been really interesting to see that as well. Another great thing that we've been able to do through the grants that we've received is we put on a winter farmers market, which I believe Representative Clem and Representative Gilliam, even though he's not here, were there to see that. And they mentioned that it was the number one most successful farmers market during winter that they'd ever seen. So it was really incredible that we got to do that. You know, and it's just been the grants that you guys are able to give to our schools has completely changed our ability to in what we eat and the things that we're able to accomplish. And, you know, it's so much bigger, you know, because when you're in a courtroom and talking about it, you know, you don't get to see the effects that it has in the lives and on the people that actually get to receive it. You know, but what we've been able to do with it and the blessings that come from it are just so large. You know, it's more important. It's not just a bill that you get to talk about all the time. You know, it's impacted us in a way that we can't thank you enough for. So we want to thank you for that. And he can talk about, my friend Laser here can talk more about the effects that it's had. So I'm going to pass it over to him.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lazar Tipikin. I'm a freshman at Malala High School, and I'm a Russian who has a blackberry farm and blueberry farm. And before I start my actual speech about this grant, we wanted to get this because it'll help my father and my family sell the berries to the schools, so it'll make more profit and more help to the cause. And I'm just a member of the Culture Club. And the thing is, Culture Club, it has reduced bullying and violence by 60% in our school district. And the eating habits from the children at the Malala High School have decreased tremendously because every single lunch, when the vegetables were in bloom, people would ask to go out into the garden and pick some vegetables, fruits, to take home or to eat during lunch. So that was a great thing for Culture Club. And being part of Culture Club, it has helped me tremendously, and it's given me so much support. They do not discriminate. We do not care if you're your race, your ethnicity, your gender, whatever it is, we do not discriminate. We support your ideas, and they help you get more ideas. And what we're here today is to ask for your support for Culture Club to help our community and to start other gardens and this grant for in other school districts. And if you give us support, we can spread this to other school districts. The State Farm to School and School Garden Program bill isn't just for us, but Malala High School is a great living example of the power of school gardens that can happen. So we thank you for, before I end my speech, I'd like to give thanks for everyone who has donated and helped us and supported us through all of this. And we thank them very much, and thank you.
Thank you, very good.
Great.
Follow that.
Say, forgive me, Chair Clem. The future of Oregon is in wonderful hands.
What can you say? I like helping out.
Okay. Dear Chair Clem and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karina Lee, and I am the executive director of the Salem Kaiser Education Foundation and a recent member of the Salem Kaiser School Board. I am here in support of House Bill 2721-1. The Salem Kaiser Education Foundation has been in operation for over 3 decades, and as the strategic nonprofit partner of the Salem Kaiser School District, Oregon's second largest, serving 41,000 children, of which 70% live in poverty and live in food deserts. SCEF is an education partner grantee and a facilitator of the Salem Kaiser School District's School Garden Program in a K-12 continuum. And we are the only school-based aquaponics system in the state of Oregon at Parrish Middle School in Representative Clem's district. We know firsthand that agriculture, food, and garden education have emerged as one of the most powerful and relevant ways to engage all students in next-generation science standards, Common Core standards, and college and career readiness. Our academic programs in the garden also expose students to post-graduation opportunities in current alignment with the Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties' regional solutions priority of growing agripreneurs. We know that healthy kids learn better. We know that kids who understand and participate in the relationship with food and agriculture and garden education have improved test scores, steady attendance, and on-time graduation. Literally, children are learning physics and engineering when they are, as they say, building water tunnels. They're actually engineering and designing irrigation systems. In one lesson this week with one of our food corps service members, they were completing a food story lesson when they were asked, "How are you going to vote with your fork?" One answer says, "I will eat food only grown in Oregon." And another said, "I will grow more food for myself at home." We are a unique education partner in that we have one foot firmly rooted in the schools and academia, and our other foot firmly rooted in our community. And our goal is to make sure all of our goals are met. The schools nor SCEF or those community partners can do it alone. House Bill 2721-1 validates the roles of those partnerships. They're critical to the success of the procurement of the financial and the human resources necessary to move academic achievement. This ecosystem of community partners is essential to bridge the urban and rural divide that actually exists in the district in the shadow of this building. This bill does two amazing things. It perpetuates and strengthens the economic vitality of our agriculture system, and it feeds the brains and the bellies of our children.
Oh, that was pretty good. That was pretty good.
Yeah, you had a tough road to hoe, but you both did quite well, all three of you. Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to ask Katie Fast, Kim Hansen, and Ivan Maluski to come up.
We need to go in that order. Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is very much in support of the Farm to School program and the Dash One amendments. It has been touched on, but I really want to stress the importance of the grant program for educational efforts. That's in the Dash One amendments. That's a new addition to the program. And it's something that, you know, from the Farm Bureau's perspective, we need in Oregon. People actively engaged in farming is less than 2% of our population. But at the same time, we're the number two economy driver in the state. And it's something that we see a disconnect between the urban population and the rural population. And this is a program that's really about blending that and letting children start learning about where their food comes from and also about the people that are grazing that food. And the programs like Adopt a Farmer, and other educational programs in the classrooms are very important in bridging that divide and something we're very much in support of, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Kim, or
I can go, sure. Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Thank you for welcoming us here to talk about Farm to School. And for the record, my name is Kim Hansen, and I'm the Food Systems Project Manager at Marion Polk Food Share. And I've worked with, for over 10 years, with Marion Polk Food Share. We're the regional food bank serving Marion and Polk counties. And I've also worked for nearly 20 years in the hunger relief arena around strengthening community food systems and increasing access for low-income people to fresh, healthy, and locally grown food. Part of my work, which is very exciting now at the Food Share, is focused on growing Farm to School in the Mid-Valley. I've had the opportunity to help author the grant for Salem-Keizer School District and also helped put in a Farm to School program at McKinley Elementary, where my kids are in fourth, well, and now sixth grade, so no longer at McKinley. But it's been very exciting to see Farm to School grow in our community. And Marion Polk Food Share, as the food bank, really envisions an Oregon where all children, families, and individuals have an opportunity to be hunger-free, healthy, and thriving so they can succeed in schoolwork and life. And part of that is really cultivating a strong regional food system. At Marion Polk Food Share, in addition to Farm to School, we work closely with the farm community to source local product for emergency food boxes. We also support 53 community and youth gardens in Marion and Polk County. Some of those are school gardens. And we're just really believe that supporting local agriculture and increasing access to local food are key to decreasing hunger and increasing community food security. I'm here today to affirm Marion Polk Food Share's support for HB 2721-1 amendment, and I really applaud the change to the non-competitive grant process. I know from working with the Salem-Keizer District, we had capacity and community partner support to put the grant in, but I'm really looking forward to seeing rural districts be able to access the grant in Marion and Polk counties, and I'm excited to work with them on making the program thrive in the Mid-Valley area. We also really support the educational part being a competitive grant process. I saw what a challenge it was even in Salem-Keizer to manage, for the district to manage both aspects of the grant, and I think it will really ease management and strengthen the impact to have the two separated. Overall, we just really increase support the increase in funding for the Farm to School program. I know what a fantastic impact the program has had on the 19 districts participating, including Salem-Keizer, where I've been able to help. And I think by increasing the funding, we can really scale up that impact for both farmers and for the kids benefiting from the program. And I just ask you today to, we've had a lot of great speakers, and I know there's hundreds more out there in the community who would have loved to have been here today sharing their story. And I would just encourage you to support the Farm to School bill and forward it on to Ways and Means with your full support. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thanks, Ivan.
Well, Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. You've heard some great testimony today, so I'll be really brief. We support the bill. We've been longtime supporters of Farm to School. The Dash 1 amendments in particular have quite a lot of merit. We support those. It would be a great way to expand access to the program to more schools statewide, but also expand access, I think, to farmers statewide more than we already have been able to do through the Dash 1 amendments, through the non-competitive grant program. We also support the funding increase. This is an important component of how do we grow this program, how do we think about it long term. These are important investments in Oregon and Oregon agriculture and Oregon school kids. I will say, personally, back at our old farm in Clackamas County, we were able to sell lettuce directly to the Jervis School District on occasion. And there's nothing quite like that feeling of being able to harvest something, provide it to school kids, help supply a school lunch program. So I know that's a feeling that a lot of producers around the state have when they participate in this program. So we encourage your support for the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming. And Peter Tripp, Michelle, and Cassandra. So I should let folks know, if you're here for 2894, there's no way we're going to end up getting to that today. So we will get to the other one, 3211.
Chair Clem, good afternoon. Members of the committee, House Committee on Rural Communities, Communities, Land Use, and Water. For the record, my name is Peter Truitt, owner and president of Truitt Family Foods in Salem here. And with me, I have Michelle M. Ratcliffe, PhD, farm-to-table specialist at Truitt Family Foods. We are here in support of HB 2721-1. Truitt Brothers, which had been in operation in Salem for 42 years, recently evolved into two separate entities. Truitt Brothers Incorporated develops co-pack products for co-pack clients, and Truitt Family Foods has developed branded products with a consumer focus in both consumer and retail markets with deep historical roots in Oregon Farm to School Initiative, now in its eighth year. I think I've got that right. 7-8.
That's good.
Yeah. Over the past year and a half, Truitt Family Foods has developed an innovative line of all-natural, shelf-stable hummus and white bean puree dippers that are ideal for the retail and airline market, and most significantly for the K-12 school food market. The work the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Education, the legislature, and community partners have done in developing the K-12 markets through the Farm to School programs has transformed school lunch in Oregon and, as a result, nationally. In fact, the strides in the K-12 Farm to School market and simultaneous changes in the distribution system have fueled the way we think about all of our markets and how we position ourselves within them. The strength of the K-12 market at home and across the country has given us the signal we needed to create the new line of healthy K-12 market-ready hummus and bean dips, which are motivated by the imperative to increase consumption of vegetables. This is a testament to the significance of the state legislative body that is supportive of Farm to School alongside the local market development activities of the state agency and partners in the public and private sectors. For the foreseeable future, our new line of products will be a very important part of our business and is made tenuous by episodic grant dollars flowing in and out of school districts. Our situation is not unique. Ingredient supply chains, production practices, and distribution networks require a reliable and ongoing quantity of sales. HB 2721-1 is a meaningful step in the right direction. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I or Dr. Ratcliffe would be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Cassandra Griffin. I'm with Upstream Public Health. We are a statewide public health advocacy organization that has been working on farm to school with many of these partners since 2006. I don't need to reiterate the many wonderful points you've heard today. You've heard from business leaders, you've heard from farmers, you've heard from kids. Everyone loves this program. It has been in effect for several years now, and it is working as it is intended. It's helping kids get healthier foods. It's helping those kids learn about what they're eating and get excited about foods, change their habits, take them home to their families. And it is helping create new markets for local farmers and local producers. So everything is going the way we intended it to. It's going well, and the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2721 are an attempt to make a successful program work even better. You've heard from a lot of people. There are even more stories out there than could fit. I'm going to tell you one more nugget that you got an email this morning but probably haven't seen yet, and then we'll call it a day on this. This morning you received an email from the food service manager from the Yamhill Carleton School District, who's another participant in this program. She says that this grant has transformed the approach she takes to finding new vendors. The first thing she asks them is whether they source Oregon products. She has more than doubled the number of local vendors she buys from in the short time that she's been participating in this program, and she looks forward to doing even more. And that's the kind of transformative impact that a little bit of investment from the state can make on what the kids are eating, what the schools are buying, and what the farmers and producers are able to sell. So we are calling on you to agree with everyone we've heard from today that there's no better way to invest in Oregon than to support our kids and our farmers and our rural communities all at once. So thank you, and we are here to answer any questions you have. Thanks for your support.
Michelle, are you talking? I would be really disappointed if the answer was no.
Chair Clem, member of the committee, I'm here to answer questions. You've heard an enormous amount of very supportive testimony from so many different people. So now's our time for question and answers.
Any questions? Well, I will just make a comment that part of what influenced my thinking was a conversation with Peter early where he mentioned that they sold in Georgia, I think it was, but Oregon as a customer wasn't really that attractive because they couldn't afford to really pay a reasonable price for a product, and that's heartbreaking. It's True Brothers is a huge employer right here in Salem and the largest producer of agricultural products, the county with the most agricultural value produced in the state, and one of the few processors who's still left, from the 50s, 60s, 70s when we had tons, didn't find our public institutions as a good customer, and I'm so happy to see now we have product lines aimed at the very customer and that there are sales in the schools. But it's been a really remarkable partnership with industry and with the schools to get to this point. And as I mentioned, for a really pretty modest amount of money, somehow, and there was a lot of private dollars that came in. Often the private dollars led the way, and then the public slowly came along behind from the Northwest Kaiser's Foundation, Northwest, what's it called?
Health Foundation.
That's the North Health Foundation.
Kaiser Permanente Community Fund of the Northwest Health Foundation.
So we've had a lot of assistance to get this far, but it really is time for the next step.
Okay, one comment.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill up. And this is the reason why I was hoping the speaker would put me on rural communities.
All right.
I'm not sure I was quite as thrilled about all the land use.
Well, that's the next hearing. Yeah.
I know. Sorry, guys. No offense, but this is a big deal. This is a big deal, and I'm really excited about this. And I'm really thank all the people who have come today and the kids. And this is kind of boring, kids. I'm sorry, but this is good stuff, and this is education, and this is fun. And I thank all the people who have been writing emails. I don't think I've received more emails on anything than this, and they've all been positive, wonderful emails. So thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I have one more stray name. Is it? Can we pass? It's Matt Huey or from Jervis. GSD is what it says, but I'm unsure. Okay, I think we're okay. It might have not even been intentional. Okay.
Work session.
We don't have our fiscal. Ooh.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
I didn't know
Thank
we
you.
Had, yeah. We,
Thank you.
And let me open a works. This is the only time you're probably going to see this whole session out of this committee in one. You don't have to sit there for it, but if you want to.
We want to.
All right, that's fine. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2721 and open a work session on House Bill 2721.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 3/17/15.
Vice Chair Post moves the -1 amendments dated 3/17/15. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I'd move HB 2721 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2721 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation that be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? The only thing I will say is that our poor colleague, who is the chief co-sponsor of this bill with me, is in surgery as we speak. We're going to have to excuse him from this vote, but otherwise I would encourage your eye support, colleagues. Any other discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent on to get our money. Now for another kumbaya moment. Land use. Okay. I will.
Good luck, y'all.
Yeah.
Pause and enjoy that.
Yeah. That's not going to happen again.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Gomberg.
While the group is leaving, I'll just note that Representative Post missed an opportunity to ask the Speaker, the Chair, or the Republican leader about the emergency clause on this bill.
That's true.
I was so excited about the tomatoes and the beans.
That's right. When the Speaker said, "Do you have any questions?"
Yeah, what topic exactly?
Yeah. Where do I start?
Oh, no.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing very quickly on House Bill 2894. I know I said I wasn't going to do that, but I realized from my list I have two people who traveled all the way here from Deschutes County to testify on that bill, and so I did not want to leave you stranded. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2894 and ask James and Jeff, is it? To please come forward. One thing I might note is I know there's amendments, and I'm not sure if you gentlemen have been informed of the amendments or you're really speaking to the original bill. So I that's just a question. The amendments are somewhat significant, but we'll take your testimony to whichever, either the original bill or the amendments.
Okay. You heard that? I heard four amendments, but do we have them? I don't think we have those.
Okay. Do you want to start?
Go ahead, John.
Chair Clem, representatives, I want to thank you very much for actually taking us today.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. No, thank you so much. Bill 2894 and others like it, moving through the legislative process, and many of which raised numerous concerns, including respective Goal 1 processes. A common theme is displacement of not only public and publicly involved Goal 1 process, but also engagement on issues by local government entities such as community development departments, planning commissions, and even county commissioners and hearings officers. Deschutes County has been a relatively proactive environment for collaborative processes for many years now. And efforts have included stream restoration projects, creation and management of groundwater mitigation banks, and cooperative in-stream lease structures. Lately, we've been facing an increasing array of challenges as the central Oregon area continues to grow. But the local process isn't breaking down. Instead, it's actually seeing an increase in public participation. Agriculture is also thriving in the area. The North Unit Irrigation District, for example, grows an amazing array of seed crops and contributes seed stock in volumes that are completely disproportionate to the area that they irrigate. North Unit Irrigation District does this while putting the least amount of water, acre foot per acre, of any irrigation district in Central Oregon. The concern that brought me over the mountains to speak today is a theme that I see in HB 2894 and other bills. That common theme is an unnecessary and, in practice, unwarranted request for expanded control by irrigation districts over projects and processes that affect the public very directly. The adverse effects of these anti-Goal 1 bills will range from degrading personal property rights to impeding many of the collaborative efforts that folks have been and remain committed to in Central Oregon. I'd respectfully request that bills like 2894 be denied your approval so that local efforts where issues are often best understood and where public participation remains robust can continue to have relevance. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ed. Thank you, Chair Clem and representatives. Appreciate it.
Chair Clem and representatives, thank you for hearing from me today. My name is James Ed Chris. They call me Ed. And I'm on the Deschutes County Planning Commission. And we had recent testimony on an issue in Deschutes County where the Central Oregon Irrigation District basically came to us to try to pipe a canal in a SR 2.5 zone. And they said to us basically that it was they were coming to us as a matter of courtesy, and they really didn't have to come to us and talk to us about this. And the obvious point that I got from it was they did not want to participate in a Goal 1 process. I volunteered to be on a planning commission in Deschutes County over the groundwater issue in South Deschutes County. So if you've heard about all that issue, especially Representative McLean. The point is that the Goal 1 process is so important in any land use decision that takes place in the state of Oregon. I really have a major issue with circumventing the Goal 1 process for any agency in the state. I just don't think that it's an appropriate thing to do. A couple of examples I can give you is we heard testimony from people whose properties were modified by the irrigation district without their okay. They weren't asked, they weren't informed, and we're talking about where trees were removed, plants were removed, and whatnot for a modification to a property. And when it was done, it was interesting that the couple just happened to be on vacation. So they weren't present when all this occurred. They came home to kind of a surprise in their backyard. And I think that kind of activity is rather bothersome to me, because you have to remember the irrigation districts were granted the easement rights by the federal government initially to move water across property. They don't own the property. They have no real money involved in that property other than in the canal that they have that they're moving water on. I'm very concerned if these districts are given the right to move around a Goal 1 process, they would go into a neighborhood like this and just do whatever they wanted to do without inquiring, talking about it, having a process. And part of the problem here would be that the people who bought the property, who have actual value in the property, who put real money into the property, would not be consulted in any way. Now, part of the bill before you, I don't know what some of the amendments are, because there was another piece that was out there that was trying to circumvent literally all Goal 1 and almost any land use process for the irrigation districts to do anything they wanted, any modifications they wanted to do to their canals. And My problem is what I noticed in our hearings, and we had a pretty doggone full room on these hearings in Deschutes County. It was very interesting that most of the landowners who were talking to us who were affected in this one area were not notified. The irrigation district stated they notified everybody. And I got a bit of a problem with how that functions. I volunteered.
I might. That is a different bill. Yeah. There will be a chance. I'm not sure we're going to hear that bill, but if we are, there'll be another chance. This one's more about the veto authority for the division.
Yeah. Right. And again, it's addressing really what I'm trying to address here is a go on process in any of this, because if they have the ultimate veto power for somebody to use their land, they already have power over their easement and access to, you know, fixing the canals and so on and so forth. But the problem here lies that the more power that's given to them over land use decisions, and if they get the ultimate veto power, even though a county or planning commission goes through all kinds of processes, spends all kinds of taxpayer money to go through this, and they just get to say, sorry, none of that counts. We don't want to hear it. And that's where I have a real problem with this. I'm not sure what amendments you have before you on that, because we haven't seen
them. Pretty significant. And you'll have time to study them, because you're testimony understand. Today, and then we're moving on.
Right. So anyway, I just wanted to basically address the go-on process, because if I'm volunteering for doing this and spending my time to try to participate and represent the people of my county well as a participant in this go-on process, and we're just going to basically nullify it for certain groups of people, then I see no reason why I should stay on a planning commission and participate in this way. It just doesn't make sense. I'd like to thank you for your time, please.
Yeah, thank you for coming over the map.
Sure, Chair Clement, I'd like to add one last thing. I submitted something to the written record that a developer in the area, Mike Knoll, dropped by this morning, and it's very directly related to 2894.
Okay.
And thank you again so much.
Yep, thanks again for being patient with us. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2894. I'll carry over House Bill 2894 to next meeting. And let me open the public hearing on House Bill 3211.
Thank you.
And we will get our first group up. Sean, can you come up? And I'm going to try and do...
Can you do Jeff?
For and against, back and forth.
So, Jeff.
Sean, Jeff. And Nellie's the next on the list. Does that work?
Yeah. Perfect.
Sean, Jeff, and Nellie. And then next in line, if I've got it right, at least, Carol Yamada. Is Carol here? Are you you're against?
Neutral.
Neutral, okay. I just got to find some neutral to against dish. So go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing a variety of developers in the Clackamas County area, including Tri-County Investments, here in support of House Bill 3211. I was hoping to go after the kids when you guys were all in a good mood and maybe get my applause too, Mr. Chair. I'm sure I'll be waiting forever. But don't worry, Mr. Vice Chair. This is also a very interesting bill. And I thought that I would bring Jeff Bachrach up with you, or with me, because you all might not know, because you're new on the committee, but Jeff is actually the one who brought the idea originally to me to come to the legislature to deal with the issue of the urban growth boundary in the metro region, which ultimately morphed into House Bill 4078 and addressed urban and rural reserves in Washington County, which I think was a pretty significant step for this legislature to take, one that we had near unanimous support on, or unanimous support going through the building. This is sort of the continuation of that process, Mr. Chair. The bill as drafted currently validates one of the more controversial areas of urban reserves that the court found in their decision to remand back urban and rural reserves, which originally started with this legislature in 2007. Giving the authority to Metro to go establish urban and rural reserves, which go beyond the 20-year UGB and actually establish areas for the next 50 years, sort of charting out our growth and where we're going to go as a metropolitan region. Of course, I mentioned sort of what happened leading into it in 2008. The process started for urban and rural reserves. 2010, they're adopted by the relative counties. 2011, Metro. And since that time, they've sort of been in legal limbo. As we try and sort them out, urban growth boundary expansions in the Portland Metro region are now bound to these new standards, as Metro has determined that that is the better path forward, which we tend to agree with, once we can finally get the urban and rural reserves established to go forward with that. The Court of Appeals decision that I mentioned, I don't know how familiar the committee is. I know the chair is, and Mr. Vice Chair, I know you're familiar with it as well. But the Court of Appeals, in the middle of our short session last year, remanded back the urban and rural reserves decision, found some specific areas of concern, broadly all of Washington County, and then more specific areas in Clackamas County, which is some of the foundation for the bill. I know that you'll hear some arguments about the precedent this would set for you all to intervene. Once again, the pledge that I think will get you all to go along with it, Mr. Chair, is if we actually solve urban and rural reserves, you guys will never see me lobby this issue again. So you could have me go away for one more bill. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions about sort of the mechanics of it. I think Jeff will probably give a little more of the legal perspective of where we're at in the remand, and I turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you, Sean. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I am Jeff Bachrach. I've been an attorney in Portland specializing in land use for 25 plus years, and I was involved in sort of the thinking on last session's House Bill 4078, the land use grant bargain. So just briefly, a little context. Sean said the current status of the urban rural reserve is in legal limbo. I'd go and say it's in legal chaos. I don't see an end to it for 3-4 years. And even at the end of that, there's no certainty what the court's going to do. They may send it back down, which is what happened last time. That was what the decision last year by the Court of Appeals sent urban rural reserves back down to LCDC. From there, presumably back to local governments, but that still hasn't happened. So a year ago, the court sent it back to LCDC. All the local governments and a lot of the private property owners have been arguing for a year, what's LCDC supposed to do with this remand? There's no agreement on how to go forward. Does it go backwards? I understand LCDC finally issued a remand order this week. That likely will get appealed. And so this thing will bounce around easily for 3+ years or more. And there's no certainty what happens at the end of the process. So I think the bill before you, my role is I'm neutral on it. I would just urge you to do what this body did a year ago, which is step in and solve the rest of the urban rural reserve process. You did it for Washington County a year ago. And by the end, as Sean mentioned, this body adopted the fix for Washington County unanimously. I think there was an implicit decision that leaving it to the process, leaving it to the legal process, was just a bad solution for the good of the state. It needed the legislature to step in and fix it, and the legislature in bipartisan fashion did that for Washington County. But you left the rest of the urban rural reserve decision for the other two metropolitan counties hanging. And it was always anticipated that urban rural reserves would be a package among the three counties in the metro area. So I think, I don't know if obligation is too strong a word, but I think implicitly, a decision has been made that the legislature is the best forum to try to solve this important problem. You started that last session, and I would just urge you, I don't know what the bill would look like, but I would urge you to again bring your talents and your ability to resolve the issue to bear and resolve it. Because if you don't, Sean will be back in 2 years, as will a lot of other people, asking you once again to solve it, because the courts are not going to solve this problem. And when you hear people today say, let the process work, I think the decision's already been made. The process isn't going to work. Everything is frozen. A lot of economic development planning, land use planning, has been frozen for 5 years in the metropolitan area. It's going to freeze for 3 more in Clackamas and Multnomah County, at least, if this group doesn't act. And so I'm encouraging you to do it. I think it's consistent with the precedent and the action you guys took a year ago to follow through and finish what you started and what, quite frankly, I think a lot of people applauded you for, a bipartisan, unanimous action. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you want to dive any deeper into the legal status, but that's...
Okay, thanks, Nellie.
Okay. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm the new executive director of the Clackamas County Business Alliance. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3211, and while the two individuals before me did a great job explaining what the bill does, I did want to touch briefly on the evidence that development will generate a substantial assessed value. John Frigganese, formerly the head of Metro, has established the future tax assessed value of willing property owners' property at approximately $2.6 billion. So this would generate county property taxes of over $77 million. He also estimates the value of the land in Stafford at $3.8 billion, which would generate over $113 million annually in property taxes. So it is something that really means a lot to the community. You will hear from several landowners, so I'll try and keep my testimony brief, but I just wanted to articulate CCBA's strong support for House Bill 3211 because it is so critical to the future of economic development in Clackamas County.
Great, thanks. We've got a bunch of people, so I'm going to try and go, and we may be back to this next meeting with those of you who are regular inhabitants, but I'm going to try and get through the citizens who are here today. So, Carol, do you want to join us? And then I can't tell because a lot of you didn't put anything. So are there other people here who either don't like the bill or are neutral on the bill? Okay, why don't you come up, sir? And Mary Kyle, why don't you come up then? Is there anybody else? That was the only third. Why don't you come up too? Mary Kyle, why don't you hold off one sec? We'll let Metro go because I've got Andy up first. And then we'll switch back after this panel to my list of Mike Weiss, Tom Lackman, Mike Miller.
Good afternoon, Les Poole. I'm from Clackamas County. Last time I spoke, I was long-winded, so I thank you. Yeah, I'll make it brief today. I've got some neutral feelings and maybe some questions about where this is going because we just heard that in a nice way the gentleman expressed that you folks got involved in last year's attempt to resolve the failure, and unfortunately that failure doesn't have an end in sight. So I'm in favor of this legislation. At the same time, I think that Clackamas County and other areas are in the long run are going to come out on the short side of it. And what I mean by that isn't financially as much as we're so short on industrial land. And when things like this happen, where something is remanded back that is the size of what occurred, and you folks are suddenly inserted into it, it's an awkward scenario. So I'm hopeful that if you move forward with this, that it's something you're not going to do in the future. But unless the process has changed, unless we look at how Metro is managing the growth boundary, I think we're going to continue to see situations that are going to drag the process out, divide communities, and put you back into the mix. I don't know what can be done to prevent some of what has occurred, but we're running out of grand bargains. There are no more grand bargains left. If anybody comes up with a solution and names it that in the future, they'll probably be run out of the building. So just walk softly here is my big message today. And hopefully we're not going to see in the future an ongoing or a repetitive way of doing things. The best thing the legislature could probably do is look at changing how the urban growth boundary and how ORS 268 could be modified to give more authority to the counties and let's end this log jam. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Les. Carol?
Hello. It's nice to be here today, and greetings to you. My name is Carol Yamada. I am the vice chair of the Stafford Hamlet. The Hamlet was created in conjunction with Clackamas County to be the voice of the the residents who live in Stafford Hamlet. And so we've been doing a lot of outreach for 8 or 9 years now to try to determine what the Stafford Hamlet residents would like to see happen in their own area. And the handout I gave you on one side is our compromise. The background of that is that we've been working on this, and that the majority of the citizens have seen a lot of change come by. We're in the urban reserve, we're out of the urban reserve, but most people don't want to develop. But the cities don't generally want to develop, but some landowners do, and the Clackamas County needs employment land. So there has to be something that happens that changes there, and we want to be involved in the change. So while we don't know if Bill 3211 is going to continue as it's currently written, if it does become a grand bargain sort of event, we really want to be part of it and represent the needs of the citizens in the area. Our compromise is to actually split the area into two kinds of designations and have the Borland area be in the urban reserve and be the employment land that the Hamlet needs, I mean that the county is asking for. And then the area north of there to be undesignated and be what the most of the citizens would like, which is to stay rural, to not have to deal with the expensive infrastructure needs that it would take to serve that area. And so there's a map on the back of the handout. It shows what is the Borland area without the Halcyon neighborhood, which don't want to be part of that. And it also shows that there's precedence for this. It's the metro, it's the results of the urban reserve discussion around the Stafford Hamlet. At that point it was called, I think it's 4A now. But you can see that the citizens group, the PAC, they said, let's develop Borland and keep North Stafford undeveloped. And then this was also the findings of the Planning Commission. The Clackamas County staff, they said to make the whole thing urban reserve, which is ultimately what happened. But it was only after 2 years of really looking carefully at the criteria for establishing a rural reserve, urban reserve, and undesignated that the citizens and the planners came up with this recommendation. So it's not a new thing. So that's basically what I came to tell you and to remind you to keep us on the list of participants in further discussions if this does indeed become a grand bargain type of event.
Thank you, Carol. Andy.
Andy Shaw, I'm the Chief of Staff to the Council President at Metro, here for Randy Tucker, who's out. Thanks for having us today, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Representing the Metro Council, we oppose 3211. First, we don't believe that this legislation is necessary. We think the legislature, you heard earlier about having sort of the principal position, we think the legislature should establish the policy and framework for local governments to make land use decisions and allow those local governments to make those decisions. The development of urban and rural reserves took many years, lots of citizen participation, lots of collaboration between cities, counties, metro, special districts. We came up with a map and approved that map by intergovernmental agreement between the cities, the counties, and metro. And while it's frustrating how long it can take to get these decisions resolved, we believe the local process needs to work its way through. Just 2 days ago, as you heard, Metro and the two counties, Clackamas and Multnomah, received a remand order back from LCDC to respond to the court's findings around specific parcels in Clackamas and Multnomah. It's a very different situation than what happened in Washington County, where the court eliminated the reserves that were agreed to in that area. So while we were a part of the agreement that came about as it then resulted in 4078, we don't believe that's the situation in Multnomah and Clackamas at all, and we don't believe that the current situation requires the legislature to get involved. Secondly, we don't think adopting a bill like this would solve any immediate crisis. Metro is in the midst of our periodic review of urban growth needs in the region, and our draft, it's a draft, we're going to work on it through the rest of the year, but our forecast of housing and employment needs does not predict that our region needs additional land this cycle. That could change before the end of 2015 as we have discussions about Damascus and other growth forecasts throughout the area. But we expect very significant growth to occur in downtown Portland and other city centers in our area. So it would likely be some time before we needed access to reserves like this for the purpose of urban growth. Lastly, the areas at least identified in the bill as it is today, and you've heard some discussion of adding or subtracting other areas, but the areas that are in the bill today would likely not be strong candidates for urban growth this cycle anyways. Normally, Metro asks a city or a local government to come forth with a planning process to pre-plan areas that are in urban reserves or outside the UGB. So we know what the infrastructure costs are, we know what the proposal is for housing, commercial, et cetera, in that area before considering expanding the urban growth boundary. There is no, and Metro provides funding for that. We have a construction excise tax funded program, a community development and planning program to offer resources to communities that want to pre-plan reserve areas. We have a few communities doing that now in hopes that they could pitch a UGB expansion this cycle. None of the lands in this bill is there a local government that stepped up and said, we'd like to do the planning and we'd like to consider being the sponsor of a expansion in this area. So even if we had a need for land this urban growth cycle, these would not likely be candidates for expansion. So for all those reasons, we urge you to oppose this measure and hold it in committee.
Great, thank you. And we're not going to do questions right now because we've got a bunch of people I still want to hear
from. I would just add that we did submit a letter to you from Council President Hughes.
Yeah, saw that. Thank you very much. Okay, let me get Mike Wise, Tom Lackman, and Mike Miller up. And you absolutely have to keep it to 2 minutes or less. If you can do it in less than that, even better. We are going to have another round next Tuesday on this. So if you can come back, you're welcome to talk again then. And you can defer now and say you'd rather have more time and wait. But if you can't come back next Tuesday, then make sure you're flagging that for me here so I can get you in now.
What time will it be Tuesday?
Same time, 1 o'clock.
I would like to talk longer than 2 minutes.
But I
could give you 2 minutes right now if you'd like.
Can you come back next Tuesday?
Yeah, I think I can.
If you can, I might ask you to wait, and then we'll give you longer that day, if that's okay.
Okay.
Anybody else that I call wants that same option, that's completely fine. So, but if you two don't want to come back next Tuesday, then let loose.
Well, thank you.
Okay, come on. Let us have it. And then I'll have Mike Miller come up in the meantime. Or can I get Mike Miller already?
My name is Tom Lackman.
Jim Standring will be next. Go ahead.
My name is Tom Lackman. I'm a 15-year resident and owner of property in the Stafford Hamlet. Until a few days ago, I was also a member of the board of directors of the Hamlet. I resigned for reasons that include my feeling that the board was not fairly representing the community. Others recognize this as well. In fact, this is why owners of over half of the buildable land in the Hamlet did not participate in the vote that the Hamlet conducted a while back. I had urged the board to do a dual majority vote as is outlined in the board, and they rejected that, and the vote was simply by the citizens. The large landowners boycotted the vote and were left out completely. Many of us think Metro is correct in having wanted to bring this area specifically into the Hamlet for many years, going back over 15 years. They just designated it urban reserve themselves. And I understand they feel a little threatened now by having to hand over some power to the legislature in this matter. But we think the area is obvious for inclusion, so close to the freeways and lots of employment, unlike other areas that have been brought in. It's obvious for inclusion. With respect to my friends and neighbors, my belief that those opposing inclusion are simply elitists looking to protect their backyard, which serves as the backyard of Lake Oswego. and they want to be excluded from the process. So they've been fighting it tooth and nail. They want to protect their views. And I've got a nice view, too. But I don't believe that's the course that should be taken here, and I strongly endorse the bill. Thank you.
Thanks. Please.
Thank you, Chair Klem and other representative committee members. My name is Michael Wise. I'm in support of Measure 3211. I've been a landowner for 12 years in the area we're discussing. I'm here on behalf of Herb Koss, who's the president of the Stafford Landowners Association. He submitted a letter to you all, but he could not be here. I told him I will be here, and I'll be quick in his support. Frankly put, as you've heard, and I think you know, there's a political and, I guess, a legal mess that's been going on for about 20 years regarding the land we're talking about. I'm going to be brief, and as I said, and tell you that House Bill 3211 affirms Metro's decision regarding needed urban growth reserve designation, that House Bill 3211, for I believe, will resolve existing lawsuits, that 3211, maybe most importantly, representatives, will create employment land and housing land that would go along with that. And lastly, in closing, House Bill 3211, frankly, in my humble opinion, which as a landowner, as a lawyer, as someone who's followed the process fairly closely, is all about controlled planning and controlled growth. In my opinion, it benefits Clackamas County in addition to Tualatin, Lake Oswego, and West Lynn, and is a bill that, as was discussed earlier by a couple different attorneys, that I think resolves a dispute that humbly I'll state is sort of why you all are here. So I urge your support for 3211. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Jim, did you want to talk today or come back?
Stay tuned.
Okay. Ted and Bonnie Halton.
They were not able to come.
Okay. Kent Sida, Mike Stewart, Rob Fallow. Okay, and you are?
Rob.
Rob. Okay.
I'm Mike Stewart.
Okay, Mike. Mm. And then I'll have, let's see, Militia? Well, why don't you tell us who you are and what we can do for you here?
I'm Mike Stewart. I appreciate your time today, gentlemen. I live in the Stafford area. I live on Johnson Road. There were two people recognized by the county as the chief petitioners for the Stafford Hamlet. We came about as a merger of the Stafford Village and the Stafford Hamlet petitions. And back in 2006, we worked through what were our opposing viewpoints and came together. I am one of those two chief petitioners. You're going to hear a lot of information about what's good and what's not good about bringing Stafford in as an urban reserve. Metro published a map, if I can just leave these over there, about employment.
Wait, she can come pick it up. It's okay.
And coincidentally, that works with when we formed our Hamlet back in 2006, and it measures jobs through 2012, and the loss of jobs in what are largely Clackamas County, that it's not broken out by county, but it's a largely all Clackamas County job losses of about 56. I gave you my copy up there, which has my notes, since there are seven people here, about 5,600 jobs. And Clackamas County deals with that unemployment on a daily basis. Stafford, a good friend of mine, works for a national construction firm. He's based here out of Oregon, works with the Portland Development Commission, and he is often asked to pick up prospective campus-type employers and bring them to locations in the area. And the question that he has always asked is, why can't we locate here? Now, if we were to look at campus sites, depending on what size you wanted to use, you could have, in 30 to 50-acre sites, you could potentially have an open door for potentially 8 employers. If you wanted to go 20 to 30 acre sites, you'd have 12 to 15 if you were to let this be planned according to the values and vision of the Stafford Hamlet, let everybody work together and incorporate an employment site, a residential site, and bring an increased tax revenue and employment to Clackamas County. Because there's only one red area in all of Portland Metro, that's Clackamas County. There are only two orange areas that are showing job losses to that degree in these last years, and that's Clackamas County. you know, they're being left out of this potential job growth. And I thank you for your time.
Okay, so from my notes here, I've got Mike Miller coming back, Jim Standren coming back, Rob Fallow coming back, Roger Martin, you're coming back, Dan Chandler. We heard from Michael Wise, I got you twice. Mary Kyle, Bob Rindy, and then Mike, the other Mike, Melita. No? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to carry over House Bill 3211, and we will see folks Tuesday. And,
I thought Vice Chair Holm was giving me a nod to go out in the hall, so I wanted to say, I'd like to testify if I could for Clackamas County.
Can you come not come back Tuesday?
I could. I'm out here every week, and
okay. There's like eight of you for Tuesday, so it'll help, because we were supposed to be out of the room 10 minutes ago. Okay, thanks, Dan. So close the public hearing on House Bill 3211 and carry over House Bill 3211. Do we need to carry over? I already got 2094 carried over.
Yep.
Sorry, that was too far. Great, and let me adjourn the committee. Great, and let me adjourn the committee.